Hello, this time on SITREP.
After Norway, the next stop for Russian forces is the UK. That's why it's key that we have a presence here.
We hear firsthand from NATO patrols in the Arctic as open source intelligence suggests there's also a notable uptick in more covert military activity there. Ed Arnold is with us to explain what could be going on. From the icy waters of the high north, we head to the wetlands of Eastern Europe. Could more peat bogs protect NATO's borders against armoured invasion? And as we're looking at using nature for defence, might militaries be able to control the weather to their advantage?
Bogs and wet forests are probably the most treacherous land for the enemy.
Defence explained.
You could create more rainfall. You could flood areas by cloud seeding into really big storms.
This is SITREP with Kate Chabot.
Well, Mike is out this week, but we're always happy to welcome Ed Arnold, Senior Research Fellow for European Security at RUSI and former British Army Infantry Officer. Welcome, Ed. How are you doing?
Great, and thank you for inviting me back.
And Ed, you've explained to us very clearly the importance of the High North on SITREP before. So what I want to start with today is understanding some of the open source intelligence we've seen posted online in recent days. On X at TBrit90 has posted tracking data showing RAF Poseidon planes carrying out what looks like an unusually high number of patrols over the Norwegian coast, pretty much constant surveillance over several days. There also appears to be an increase in US Poseidon flights. Ed, what would they be looking for? Is it just submarines?
Well, it's mainly submarines, but it's also this element that the Arctic and High North are very important for both NATO and Russia. And the activity there has increased as escalation between the two countries has increased. Both countries are also doing exercise, which are now really kind of blending into operations. And actually the UK, the US and Norway operate a sort of trilateral agreement on the P-8 Poseidon, which means that they can increase availability of aircraft and they can see as much as possible. We're really in that stage now with Russia where it's just persistent, constant surveillance. And it's such a huge area that really you have to rely on all sensors. And that's why open source activity here is so prevalent.
And we're going to talk a bit more in a moment about the ships of NATO's Standing Maritime Group, one patrolling in the Arctic and High North. Could this simply be part of that, covering their backs, or does it suggest something else to you, Ed?
Well, no, I think it is covering their backs. But this is the whole point, that you have a persistent presence, you have persistent surveillance of the area, and then you can understand data changes. But if you're not up there all of the time, you can't really see that. So it's got to be this persistent level. And then when you start to see trends, you can then look into them deeper. And you also do need to be present up there. I think there's also an element here of signaling to Russia that we can do this, we will do this in an area which is contested. So this is just likely to continue. And it is one of those sort of slightly different things, as we've talked about Arctic exceptionalism for such a long time now, where sort of what happens in the rest of Europe doesn't really affect the Arctic. I mean, that is now gone. You know, Ukraine a couple of years ago struck a Russian installation in the Arctic. So actually the war in Ukraine has come to the Arctic Circle already. And I think it's a mindset change that all Europeans need to get on board with.
Okay, and then we have something more intriguing. Flight data showing a very specialised US plane, a Constant Phoenix, flying for several hours on Monday, not quite in the High North, but over the Baltic. Now, this is a plane that samples the atmosphere for evidence of nuclear activity. It flew from RAF Mildenhall. And parts of its flight path looked like a bit of a scrawl. What might it have been there for?
Yeah, I think when you see the data and the sort of how it's presented, you can really localize sort of what those assets are really looking into. And again, this will be something that is fairly routine. But then in terms of the tempo of these operations, they're obviously looking for something. And, you know, in terms of the nuclear dimension, I mean, you know, Russia has been good at signaling in terms of its nuclear rhetoric to NATO and the US in context of the war in Ukraine. Not that they'd use those types of weapon systems within Ukraine, but saying, you know, it's always this constant reminder, we have nuclear weapons, we are a great power, you need to take us seriously. And sort of testing these missiles or, you know, uncovering, doing drills in terms of uncovering their strategic nuclear weapons, you know, potential ready to fire. It's just, it's a mechanism that the states use. I mean, look at North Korea. They do it periodically over time. And again, I think the issue that we need to now look at is how often does it happen? Is it in relation to any other diplomatic activity that's going on in the world, which is almost certainly going to be linked to potential negotiations over Ukraine. Again, it's Russia reminding everyone that they have nuclear weapons. They're a great power. They need to be taken seriously.
Okay, and the final piece of reporting to look at is the Barents Observer says it's tracked a Russian surveillance plane, a Beriev A-50U, flying to an Arctic island off Siberia. Now, these planes have been pretty much dedicated to Ukraine for the last 3 and a bit years. Some experts say it points towards Russia preparing to test a nuclear-powered missile. What do you make of it?
Yeah, well, I think whether it's to test or it's to do something to demonstrate Russia's power in the Arctic, I think that's the issue. And it also needs to be looked in sort of the wider context of what's going on, because even in terms of ground formations, you know, new tanks coming off the production line, European intelligence suggests that they're not being initially invested into the fight in Ukraine, even though that the Russians are on the offensive, suggesting that they're either being held back for example, training for future offensive operations, or they're potentially being kept back for something else. So again, it's part of this picture. It's looking at the totality of the Russian military and seeing what's invested in Ukraine and what is invested elsewhere, because then that will give you the indicator of if the Russians are planning to do something, for example, in the Baltics or the Nordics.
So can you see a potential then for these three things to be parts of the same jigsaw, or would that be unlikely given the geographic separations?
I think really that, you know, related to Russia is part of the same jigsaw, because when you're looking at it from a military perspective against Europe, I mean, the two theatres are absolutely interlinked. And the issue at the moment is that the Russians can't really pose a credible threat to NATO in the short term because they are so invested within Ukraine and still fighting at that intensity. And that is why that all of these NATO assessments of when Russia may be ready to reconstitute and pose a threat to Russia, they're all predicated on the current fighting stopping at its current intensity. Therefore, you know, in terms of Europe, the real risk is that if there is a ceasefire in Ukraine or something that moves to a negotiated settlement, that effectively starts the clock on, you know, where the Russians can then threaten Europe in another region.
Right. Well, let's now get first-hand understanding of what NATO is currently doing at sea in the Arctic. BFBS Forces news reporter Sophie Kakayanis is just back from several days with NATO's Standing Maritime Group 1, which is currently patrolling the furthest north it's been in decades. Hi, Sophie. How was it? What were they doing up there?
Hi there. So Standing NATO Maritime Group 1 is one of four NATO naval task groups available 24/7. And what that means is whether it's reconnaissance, rescuing, or warfare, these NATO vessels are ready to react to developments at sea in NATO waters. And as a result, they're providing deterrence and they're ensuring maritime security. And when you look at who's involved, the deployment involves all the NATO nations taking it in turns to be flagship of the group. So currently, the command of the group is from the Royal Netherlands Navy, and that's where we went to join. And the chief of staff is British from the Royal Navy. And we were on board their current flagship, which is the HNLMS De Ruyter. As the flagship, that's where the command staff live and work from. And they're responsible for protecting the fleet against both sea and air threats, including, of course, any enemy aircraft and missiles. And they've got an assortment of systems, as I'm sure you can imagine, depending on what threat they're facing. So their last resort is their Goalkeeper, an extremely accurate weapon system. It can take out high-speed missiles, aircraft, drones. And another crucial component is their SMART-L extended long-range radar. So that's detecting and tracking multiple targets at the same time over hundreds of kilometres, a really evolved bit of kit. And not to mention as well, their NATO NH90 helicopter, which is just a great asset for submarine hunting, equipped with 360-degree radar and it can be loaded with torpedoes as well. But it's not just the Dutch, as we said, it's a group. So when we joined the group at the time, alongside the flagship, they were working with a German tanker and a Portuguese frigate. And on the flagship itself, although it was a Dutch ship, there are a mixture of NATO nationalities. So as we mentioned, the chief of staff was British. But the group is restricted by availability of NATO vessels to come and join them. So they are swapping throughout. And I was told, you may see three ships now, but if something happened, we would soon become around 12 ships.
So this is the furthest north they've been in decades. Why have they pushed that far up now?
Well, for many years, despite Russia controlling over half of the Arctic's coastline, so that's 24,000 kilometres, the Arctic was relatively a peaceful region and there was cooperation between Russia and the West. But as we've alluded to, Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022 has changed the security dynamics there. So Russia becoming more isolated from the West, pushing Finland and Sweden to join NATO, which now means 7 of the 8 Arctic nations are NATO members. And in retaliation, Russia's been building up its military presence in the name of defending its borders, but also using the Arctic as a testing ground for missile systems they would use in Ukraine. So I get a sense it's never been a question on whether this region is important, but more a case of other areas of the globe have needed more urgent attention, but the war in Ukraine has now thrust the Arctic back into the spotlight.
Obviously, we're very much looking at what Russia is doing. You're talking about aggression. You're specifically talking about the situation in Ukraine. Obviously, we are concerned. We keep a lookout. They keep a lookout. But the interaction has been very professional. I think their numbers are down a bit. We used to see more activity. My guess is that all the stuff they're doing has them a bit stretched.
If there was going to be attack from Russia, what would your estimation be it would look like?
I don't think I'm going to answer that. I know that because obviously we've been having exercises and we've been planning, but I'm not going to let you look into my cards.
Nice try, Sophie. Good on you. Ed, what's your best assessment of what a Russian attack in the Arctic might look like? What would they want to attack?
Well, I think the issue, particularly from a UK point of view, that if Russians were going to attack the UK as part of a deliberate Kremlin policy to attack NATO, that attack has to come from the north due to geography. So it sort of shows why it's so important to the UK. But actually, I don't think necessarily a deliberate Kremlin attack will happen from the Arctic. I think it's far more likely to happen just through miscalculation due to the amount of ships and aircraft now transiting within the Arctic and the high north. And just the operational tempo on both sides is that great at the moment that is probably the greatest risk. And also you have, two sets of forces that are maneuvering. It's far less likely to happen in the Baltics through an accident because you have relatively static forces. So I think it's really important to watch the Arctic, that something might happen accidentally, and that will then require a policy response from NATO.
And Sophie, you mentioned earlier ships having to come and go depending on their commitments. The question in many people's minds would be, why is the Royal Navy doing this when it's so heavily committed and to some minds struggling to cope with threats much closer to home?
Yeah, it's a fair point. And although the UK is not an Arctic state, when you think of the geography of the UK in relation to Russia travelling towards the Atlantic, there are some stark realisations, as the Chief of Staff of Standing NATO Maritime Group 1 highlights.
What we call the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap is basically the gateway for Russian forces to enter the Atlantic and for their submarine force as well to enter the Atlantic. After Norway, the next stop for Russian forces is the UK. So that's why it's key that we have a presence here, why we have the ability to operate here.
What impact does
NATO being here in the High North have on Russia, given the war they're fighting in Ukraine at the moment?
Well, it just gives them a dilemma to think about, of us operating next to them, which we have every right to do. And of course, it's in the backyard of one of our main NATO partners, Norway.
Now they've done several exercises in the High North. The Maritime Group are heading to other parts of Europe for the rest of the year before another NATO country then takes over the commanding group in the new year.
And so if you're looking at your film from the trip, it looked quite nice and sunny, really. What were the conditions like?
Yeah, August off the coast of Norway meant sunglasses, but also thick winter jackets. Although it wasn't the roughest of seas, there was definitely enough rocking that you'd find yourself involuntarily rolling in your bunk bed at night.
And this is a multinational deployment. Important question right now for anyone going on one of those. Who's in charge of the food and was it any good?
Well, I had the chance to sample the Dutch version of a full English breakfast, which included...
What's that?
Well, it included frankfurters, which was definitely a first. I hadn't had an English breakfast with frankfurters before. But the best bit, something new I learned, I don't know if our listeners may know this, but it's very common on Dutch ships to have a bakery on board.
Mm.
So all of the bread at mealtimes is freshly baked on ship. Apparently it's great for morale, which I can confirm it was. and the best bit is that if your birthday happens to fall during a deployment, the baker will make a cake for you. How great is that?
Brilliant. And Ed, you were nodding away at that. Have you had some experience of the Dutch bakery on board?
I have, of Dutch bakeries, of Royal Navy chefs. I mean, yeah, the food's pretty good. It has to be.
Brilliant. Sophie, thank you very much for sharing this with us. And you can see Sophie's film, Frozen Frontline, on the BFBS Forces News YouTube channel. Okay, Ed, let's move on from bakeries and talk about something you brought to our attention with a post on Blue Sky a couple of days ago. The idea that European countries having to draw up new environmental strategies could kill two birds with one stone by flooding drained wetlands to create peat bogs. The original driver is that the bogs can absorb huge quantities of carbon and so help fight global warming. But the thing about boggy land is tanks, smaller vehicles, even people would sink when they tried to cross it. Both Poland and Finland told Politico this week that they are actively looking at the defensive potential of restoring bogs. Ed, something a bit like this was done deliberately and very effectively at the start of the Ukraine war.
Yes, it was to the north of Kyiv, effectively, so flooding wetlands to the north, which meant that Russian armour struggled to sort of to get through. And it's something that a lot of militaries do. I mean, the Novokarkovka Dam as well in June 2023, I mean, that caused the ecological disaster, but also what it did was it widened the Dnieper River to the south, so it prevented the Ukrainians from continuing the offensive from Kherson, again using a natural defensive barrier, which is the Dnieper River, that effectively comes all the way through the middle of Ukraine to their advances. So this is something that militaries do. I think the distinction is that we're, you know, with the defense of Kyiv, it was done very hastily. So in defense is sort of two type in the military, there's two types of defense: hasty and deliberate. And what we're now talking in terms of Europe is doing this deliberately, doing it in such a way that it supports the NATO defensive regional plans.
And let's take one potential example. Estonia already has nearly 10,000 bogs that are more than a hectare in size. We know that because this fact is proudly declared among the signs for visitors arriving from the ferry into Tallinn. I know this because our producer saw it and showed a photograph of it to me. How realistic is it for even more to be created in the right places so that they could double up as simple but very effective tank traps? Avelina Helm is Professor of Restoration Ecology at University of Tartu in Estonia and has also advised the country's government on this.
Estonia has quite a long border with Russia, around 285 kilometers or so. A large part of it is a lake, Lake Peipus, which is already a good natural defense border, but the rest of it is very different. In the northeastern part, we have large areas of bogs and wetlands that have historically also been very important in protecting our country from our very long-term enemy from the east. And even during the Second World War, the bogs in this area were refugia so to say, for the military personnel and for the local resistance to fight against the enemy. So now we are looking at the situation that a lot of bog areas, a lot of wetland areas, also wet forests, have been drained over past, let's say, 100 years. And out of Estonian wetlands, 2/3 of them have been drained for forestry, for agriculture. And this, of course, changes also the landscape permeability for the vehicles, of course, that the drained areas, they have much more possibilities to go through than bog areas and wetlands.
And so if 2/3 of the bogland area has been drained for agricultural purposes, can you just tell us about the scope to increase the bogland if you should want to reverse that? How much more land can you get back to bogs?
Yes, well, we have estimated here in Estonia that for the biodiversity reasons, we need to restore around 20,000 hectares of wetland areas. We have already, over past 10 years, restored the hydrological regime in around the same area, 20,000 hectares. Half is done, let's say. But until now, we have not looked this possibility or these actions in strategic way regarding the defense. Of course, the planning has been primarily based on the biodiversity benefits and the hydrological regime. So the easiest and the most relevant places have been on the focus.
So how do you actually do it? And is it different if you're doing it for ecological reasons as opposed to defensive reasons?
I would assume that it is a bit different, but not too much. In Estonia, we are in this relatively lucky situation that we also have quite a lot of drained bog areas that have not been taken into active agricultural use. So they have been drained, they are dry, but they are still bogs. They just don't function as wetlands, and they are not wet. In these cases, we just need to make a hydrological model for the landscape and then very strategically close the ditches that drain the whole landscape or the whole bog system. This results in quite a quick accumulation and raise of water level in the wetland area, and it very, very quickly also makes the land quite wet. Of course, ecologically it takes then time to function, but hydrologically they already can be quite wet within a year.
And where potential bogs have been drained and dried out, that's been done for a reason, as you mentioned earlier. What are the potential downsides of re-wetting them?
Yes, of course, the re-wetting has impacts on how the landscapes look, how they function. And sometimes when they are close to villages or settlements, then local people get worried whether it changes much for them, whether their roads get wet, or the forests that have been grown on the dry drained areas, whether they die or what happens with them. They need to be carefully planned and mitigated, all these worries as well. But we also have the luck here to have relatively low population density in the rural areas. So there are kind of also large opportunities for very targeted restoration of these wetlands, especially now if we look into eastern border.
You mentioned earlier the use of bogs for protective purposes, for troops, for defences. What about the more woodland or other potential natural obstacles for defence?
Yes, bogs and all kinds of wetlands and wet forests are probably the most treacherous land for the enemy. You can never predict what you meet there. While for the locals who know the land, they can be quite an ally, these kind of wetlands and wet forests. But also it has been estimated that forests themselves with large trees and with bushes, you have higher trees, you have different levels, you have larger trees, you have shrubs, that this is also in defense way, this is a good landscape. So there is discussion right now in Estonia as well, whether clear cuts versus keeping the forests upstanding, whether this changes the landscape's permeability for enemy.
How seriously is the Estonian government thinking of these natural defences in terms of a potential aggressor and for the future?
Regarding the existing natural defences and the landscapes, I believe they are very well mapped and the landscape is quite well assessed regarding how and where potential conflicts might arise and how the nature itself or the landscapes can contribute to this. But what has not been really done is assessment of the change of the landscape. To my knowledge, there is a discussion, at least in right now, between the ministries that are responsible for either landscape change, restoration of habitats, and the defense ministry. The Ministry of Climate is currently preparing national restoration plan, like all EU countries. And within this plan, it would be very wise already to foresee these kind of aspects and to work together.
Professor Aveliina Helm, it's been great speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ed, from your infantry days, what would your options have been if you came up against a peat bog?
Well, in terms of my infantry days as an officer, I think if you accidentally navigated your way into a peat bog, your soldiers would be pretty annoyed with you. you know, ground is difficult to maneuver on. Anyway, but I think looking back onto my infantry days, it was very, very different to what we see now just because of persistent surveillance, primarily through drones of the battlefield. I mean, you can't hide on a battlefield. So previously, I might have thought, well, actually, if I'm a dismounted ground combat call sign, I might try and get through that bog and I might sneak around and the enemy might not think I'm coming from that location. But actually now you can't really do that. And, you know, bogs are not just there to slow enemy, get their boots wet, you know, lose a couple of vehicles. They're used to channel forces. And this is where, you know, back to my earlier point of sort of deliberate defense, what we can do now is look into that and say, well, actually, where do we want to? Because obviously if forces go up towards a bog, they slow down. And if they slow, they can be targeted. So mm-hmm. This is all about being very selective and making sure that NATO also has the firepower and the surveillance to make the best use of it.
And if we go back to Roman and Greek times, they would choose natural defensive features, including peat bogs, when deciding where to build settlements. So this has a long history. But are we all of a sudden having to relearn the lessons about just how effectively we can use nature for our defence?
I don't think it's necessarily about relearning lessons. It's more the fact that we're relearning that we need to be prepared to stop a Russian advance into Europe. And we are looking at all of the available options. And, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, if you're looking at creating a deliberate defense of an area, you initially look at your natural terrain, you know, high ground, hills, mountains, etc. And then you sort of build it up from there. And I mean, quite literally, when I was an intelligence officer in the MOD, I mean, part of my job that I did with the battle group engineer is you effectively put a big piece of plastic over a map and you just color in the natural features. You know, if you're doing that for sort of 45 minutes, you then very clearly get an understanding of that ground in front of you, where you need to put your troops, where you need to see, you know, where you might need to put drones in, OPs, observation posts. And it is all about channeling the enemy so that they can be attacked, destroyed, killed.
Well, given we're exploring how to use nature to our military advantage, we thought we'd be a little more speculative this week in our exploration of technologies that could be truly transformative for militaries. The weather can make or break a military campaign in just a moment. So what if we could control the weather, at least to some extent? BBC weatherman Simon King, who's also served on global operations with the RAF, has been explaining all.
There's a couple of very famous quotes, really. The first is from the Irving Kirk, who was an American meteorologist. And he said that the nation that first acquires control of the weather shall be the leading power in the world. And there's this recognition that if you could control the weather, you could use that as a weapon for war, or even just in the most basic terms, really using that to your advantage to gain the upper hand. And that's certainly something that we see now today with the mobile met units. And the importance of meteorology is having the upper hand of knowledge of the weather over the enemy forces.
And are you able to tell me how far those efforts have come?
Well, I can go back in time because we have seen it used before. I'll give an example. In 1942, during World War II, a lot of our air stations in the east of England were susceptible to fog in October, November. So Churchill said to his leading scientific advisor, Lord Cherwell, that he had to come up with a solution with utmost urgency to try and solve the fog problem. So the way they came about that is basically by putting these fire pits all along the runway and lighting hundreds of thousands of gallons of fuel and petrol and kerosene per hour. But the heat that it generated basically helped to clear the fog. So that is one way of weather manipulation. You know, there was a foggy morning, they lit these fire pits and the Spitfires and the aircraft were able to take off and land. And it said to, at the time, have shortened the war and saved many thousands of lives because they were able to control the fog and clear it. And there's another really good example during the Vietnam War, Operation Popeye. It was highly classified at the time. And basically, the Americans wanted to, well, they basically cloud seeded. So one of the weather squadrons there, their motto was make mud, not war. And they basically cloud seeded over the Ho Chi Minh Trail and the supply routes for the Vietnamese army to make it rain more. And that just created more mud and that disrupted their supply chains. And again, that was deemed as a success in modifying the weather to military advantage.
And can you just explain a little bit more about how cloud seeding actually works?
Yeah, sure. So you essentially can't make a cloud out of nothing. So the way it works is that forecasters would identify cumulus clouds, so those rain-bearing clouds. And what they would do is you would fly into those and you'd spray a silver iodide or a natural salt into that cloud. And what you're basically doing there is you're increasing the number of cloud condensation nuclei. So every raindrop starts out as a very tiny nuclei, a speck of dust or pollen or a bit of sand. And that's how a water droplet will basically attach itself to and to create a rain droplet. So the more of these kind of particulates that you can put into a cloud, the more condensation nuclei you can have. The idea is that you can generate more raindrops and therefore produce more water from that cloud.
Quite an example. And if we look across science and research as a whole, how capable are human beings and their technologies of manipulating weather?
So I've given you some examples there in history, but actually what happened after the Vietnam War and the use of this cloud seeding to gain the military advantage is that in 1976, nations came together and they put together the NMOD protocol, which basically was a protocol to ban or make illegal or prohibit any type of weather modification for war. So since then, we haven't seen any of this kind of manipulation, modification. And actually, you know, even though they did this cloud seeding, it's unknown how successful that was. The science was still very, very early in the days there. I mean, today, we do cloud seeding, not the UK, but nations, the Americans do it. More particularly so in the United Arab Emirates, they cloud seed quite regularly to get more water from their clouds to basically help their water resources. But to my knowledge, there's no weather modification happening today in terms of warfare because of this protocol, the NMOD protocol that would prohibit it.
And so the NMOD treaty currently prevents the use of weather manipulation by militaries. But if it were to be broken, realistically, how much use could that be put to?
Well, again, it's the things that I'm thinking of that could be used is this cloud seeding. So some things that you could potentially, you know, theoretically, what you could potentially do, you could create more rainfall. You could flood areas potentially by cloud seeding into really big storms and creating more water. There is one suggestion perhaps that this cloud seeding, a problem with it might be is that if one nation were to cloud seed and generate more rainfall from that cloud over a particular area, as that cloud or that bit of air then travels to another nation, for example, there wouldn't be that moisture, there wouldn't be that availability of rainfall. So again, potentially you could create a drought in a particular area. And of course, if you create drought, that can cause other issues with migration and, you know, you might have the upper hand on a particular nation because of, you know, the fact that you've taken all their water. So cloud seeding is the big one where you could potentially use that for weather modification. But really, the technology isn't there. I mean, there are suggestions that you could use big bombs to divert hurricanes or weather systems that you could potentially divert those. But I mean, we're so far-fetched in science here that it just wouldn't be possible.
And most of the other technologies we talk about are digital and almost only limited by our imaginations in the long term. Long term, could we get much more capable in manipulating the weather, do you think? Or are we already pushing the physical limits?
I think we are already pushing the, well, in terms of weather modification, as I said, there are nations that do the cloud seeding. But in terms of anything else, we are, it's just not possible. You know, could potentially in the future, you could be in a situation where you could do more things. I really don't know. I really don't think there's the technology there to do much else with weather modification.
So we have the ENMOD treaty, as you've said. Are we likely, though, to see weather manipulation used effectively in war in the foreseeable future at all?
I doubt it very much. The ENMOD was brought in 1976. And since then, to my knowledge, of course, there may be covert operations and things that are going on that I've got no idea about. I can't comment on. But in terms of my own knowledge about that, that treaty has stood the test of time. And I think the problem is that the technology isn't there. I don't think people really could see any benefit of the weather modification at this stage in time. And that's not to say that in the future things could change. But I think that's, you know, potentially, I think we are so far away from that it may not happen.
And just a final thought, Simon, how much difference could increased computing power, things like quantum, provide for more useful weather forecasts? And could that be game changing?
Yeah, well, of course, you know, weather forecasting in itself is always changing. And we've recently seen a huge increase in computing power for weather forecasts. And certainly during my time in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we had very coarse, very low resolution weather forecast models, and putting a weather forecast together was very tricky. You did your very, very best, but you still got caught out with dust storms that just came out of nowhere. The wind would suddenly pick up, and then you'd have to call back assets from where they're being deployed to because of the weather was turning. So absolutely, in terms of the weather forecast and in the future, getting that more accurate can only benefit, you know, allied nations, you know, even more so. So our weather forecasts becoming more accurate are undoubtedly going to help operational tempo. We know that already, that having a very good weather forecast can maximize what we can do now, and that will just happen more so in the future, having much more detail, much more high resolution weather forecasts in conflicts around the world.
Really interesting to talk to you, Simon King. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kate.
So, Ed, the potential sounds pretty limited. From exercises to operations, the weather is always going to have the capacity to make or break you, though, isn't it? I guess the bigger hope is better forecasting technology. Know the weather, even if you can't change it.
Yes, I think you're right. I agree with Simon. I think the difficulty is not necessarily the technology to do weather manipulation. It's actually integrating it within to the planning system, especially now in modern war where you're trying to integrate so many other things, you know, AI, etc. I mean, you know, weather manipulation would really sort of require a lot of effort, which would probably be taken out of elsewhere. But yes, I think the forecasting element's really important. We see that even at the moment. I mean, yes, in Afghanistan, I think, you know, it wasn't a case of what's the temperature going to be, because it could be hot and it's pretty much going to be every day. But, you know, inclement weather such as sandstorms, which would then take down intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance assets. It's the same now with cloud cover all of that. So I think historically, you know, where it's happened most was Group Captain James Stagg, it was his job to look at the weather data that was coming from Ireland and the Atlantic to work out the date for D-Day. And he did it exceptionally well, but there was a lot of weight on his shoulders. And there was a period just before the 6th of June, had they gone there, that it would have been very difficult. And actually around 10 days afterwards, there was a huge storm in the English Channel, and it took out a lot of the harbours that had been erected on D-Day. So kind of in terms of the weather and his job, you know, in terms of D-Day, I mean, the success of that mission almost actually just counted on the weather data. And that's why in the military planning process that NATO used, it's right front and center. It's about the ground, it's about the weather, and that gives you your options when you choose to do operations. And also from a defensive position, it can also suggest when the enemy might be coming at you because it's favorable weather on their side as well.
What about you, Ed, during your career? Have you ever been caught out by an inaccurate weather forecast while on operations?
Not fully inaccurate, but there were a couple of surprises. I mean, mainly in Afghanistan, yes, sandstorms, because that's quite difficult if you're out on the ground at that time and ISTAR can't support your patrol. You'd want to try and get back to base. But I mean, mainly it was just sort of rain, and more rain on training areas within the UK, which... yeah, you get used to, and it's good to train in that type of environment with bad weather, because then if you're on operations and it's decent weather, then it feels a lot easier.
Ed, great to speak to you. Thank you for joining us today, and thanks to all of our guests. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark will be back with me for another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, don't forget you can watch Sophie's film On Patrol with NATO in the Arctic on the Forces News YouTube channel. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye.